Exit number 12096, rail 3.
Mr. David Craig, rail 3.
Well, Captain asked us, does anybody know anything about bombs? And of course we said, well, no, we know they make a big bang because we've seen plenty of them, but as far as the technical side of it, we know absolutely nothing. However, the Navy told us that if there were delayed action bombs, they would either go off in 12 hours or 24 hours, which was gave us some comfort. So we had no bomb disposal equipment, nothing. So we borrowed some shovels from the stokehold, and we said, well, the first thing we've got to do is dig the thing out before we can do anything else. Get down to it, because we don't know what it is, we don't know what it looks like. We haven't seen one at close range like that before. So we took the hatch covers off, and we rigged a derrick, and we started digging. But the Navy sent HMS Jason, who was a minesweeper, up to anchor about a mile astern of us, and she was under orders to come along. So I have that note still in my possession, actually written out by the SBNO North Russia. HMS Jason is to anchor astern and come alongside and render assistance if the bomb explodes. That was the basis of the message. Well, it was quite comforting to have the Jason, because she used to call us up occasionally and ask us how we were getting on, and I was the only one left that could use an Aldous lamp and signal to her, so consequently I had to work on deck. We all wanted to take turns, you see, down below, but the boys down below used to shovel the coal into a big tub we had, and we used to bring it up with the derrick, tip it on deck. Well, we had to spread it out in deck because it was good British steaming coal which we were using for getting home. And aside from that, the Russian coal we used to get when we were up there, it was no use. We used to say when you blew the whistle, your engine stopped. You couldn't get up steam with it. It was very low quality. So therefore, we wanted to save our own coal. And on deck, those of us on deck spread it out, you know. But I must say this, if you put your shovel down to wipe the sweat off your brow, when you turned around, somebody else had picked the shovel up, and you had to wait your turn because we had more men than we had shovels. And it was a question everybody was wanting to get on with it. Well... We dug, and if you're digging in a confined space, you're inclined to dig down towards a point, you see. Well, when we got down about 10 feet, we found the tail fins of the bomb, and by the size of it, we reckon it must be a 1,000-pounder. It was quite a big fins, which it turned out to be. But the trouble is, digging that way, the Germans came back, you see, they discovered what we were up to, so they thought they would just bomb us for good luck, you know, if they could set the bomb off in the bunkers. They saw us trimming the coal, the reconnaissance planes would see us putting the coal out in deck, and they'd say, why does a merchant ship open its hatches and take its coal out in deck at this stage? But they realised then, they probably could see the hole in the deck because it was a big round hole, you see. And when that happened, the coal used to fall in, you know, it used to fall in, and the squad working down below, and they had to get out the road quick because of the merchant ship, the concussion of the guns alone itself used to shake the whole ship, you see. Well, and any bombs going off alongside shook the ship and it went further back in. But to cut a long story short, after about the first day, I'll better tell you this, the Russians, they discovered what we're up to, and they sent out a Russian bomb disposal officer, a man by the name of Panin, P-A-N-I-N is his name, and he was a naval bomb disposal officer, and he came aboard, but we couldn't speak. We don't speak Russian, and he didn't speak very much English, but you know, we were doing the same job. So his job was to take the detonator out if we could get it up on deck. Well, after we worked all through that, with 2 days and two nights actually, before we finally got down to the bomb, and as I say, to cut a long story short, we got a strop round it, that's a rope round the middle. It was rather funny, when we got to it, we thought that bombs had detonators in the nose, but this one didn't. This one was halfway up the side. So therefore we assumed that it was an armour-piercing bomb, you see. And they asked me to have a look at it because I was the electrical man in the outfit. And I said, well, there was two studs on it, and I scraped the dirt off. Excuse me. And round the studs were insulation. So I reckoned that it must be on charge on the plane. So that when it leaves the plane, there's an electrical charge on it, and when it hits anywhere, that'll set the detonator off and set the primer off and blow it up, you see. Well, that proved to be correct, actually. But we got a rope round it, and we used the derrick, and we hoisted it out in deck. And I'd gone up to the bridge to call up HMS Jason to tell her we'd now got it out in deck, you see, but we're going to try and get the detonator out of it. And one of the boys came up and they said, Sparks, you better come down and write your name on it, because we've all got our names on it and you're not the only one that hasn't got it on. So I went down and it was all covered with names, but the only place I could get room was by scraping the muck off round the detonator and writing my name around the detonator, you see, which was a stupid thing to do, but well, we were young and daft in these days. So the Russian, he said, he would take the detonator out. Well, there was about three of us, three of the ship's officers and the Russian, and he started to screw the retaining ring. The detonator's held in with a retaining ring, you see, with a couple of wee studs in it. And he started to screw it out, and he got about a couple of turns, and then it stuck, and it wouldn't shift. And the bold boy goes into his pocket, and he comes out with a hammer and a wee punch, and he starts punching it, you know, to get it going, like an engineer does to get a bolt off. And I can honestly say, every time he hit that, the hair in the back of my neck stood up straight, because I had a duffel coat on, and I could feel it, I could feel it brushing against it. But however, he finally got the ring off, and he took the detonator out, and took the primer out. And the bomb, of course, then is basically harmless, because you need to detonate high explosives. But we took the end off, we took the flange off the end of the bomb, and it was a kind of yellow powder, I think it was amatol. I remember taking some of it and putting a match to it to see what would happen, but it just burned, you know, it was like cordite. It needs to be detonated before it goes off. So we eventually dumped it over the side into the Kola Inlet. And then we went back alongside for repairs, and we had, because the bomb that had gone through the second deck, the down below it, had cut the engine room telegraphs, it had cut the steering communication from the bridge to the after end, it had cut all the telephone lines and everything like that, so we had to go in and get that repaired. Then we went back out to Anchorage again. But on the captain's orders, we had 2 nights, absolutely do what you like. Paint the town red if you like, but you couldn't do that in Russia, I'm afraid. So we were free to do what we wanted. But after that, we went back out to the inlet, and we were there till about the 17th of May. We were still being attacked by these German planes. They were a pest. And eventually, there was 4 ships damaged. Wait, let's see, I've got that's right. The Empire Kinsman, the Doverhill, the British Governor, and the Landaff were all damaged. Well, were damaged at that time, and we set out from Murmansk to go around the White Sea, mainly to make it a wee bit safer during the summer months, because we were damaged and we didn't want to get damaged anymore. So we went round to outside a place called Economia, outside on the Dvina River, outside Archangel. And we lay there from the 20th May till the 18th July. And I was looking my diary up. We had 1 or 2 raids there, but I can't remember them, because they must have been insignificant to the ones we had in the Kola Inlet. And after that, we loaded fertilizer, I think, to try and hold us down a wee bit. And we went round to a place called Molotovsk in the White Sea, which is now called Severodvinsk. It has changed its name when Molotov fell from grace. And we lay there till 26 November, which was the dark nights were coming back again, and it was nearly dark for 24 hours. But the trouble was, in the White Sea, we ran out of food. Food was desperate short, you know. We suffered from malnutrition at one stage. We used to draw our rations. Officer in Manalite used to get a tin of condensed milk for a fortnight. And that was all right when it was condensed milk, because it would last out a fortnight. But when we ran out of condensed milk, it was ideal milk. And that wasn't so good, because it wouldn't last for a fortnight. So what you did was, the three radio officers got together, or three of somebody else got together, and you just said, well, we'll open your tin for so many days, you see, and that kept us going. But food was very scarce. I mean, your breakfast would be a slice of fried Spam and black bread, rye bread, which I dislike intensely, but you had to eat it. And then for lunch, if you were lucky, if there was any cabbage soup going, you know, in the summer months you could occasionally get a cabbage or two, and you boiled it up. And I hate cabbages, but it was cabbage soup, and you ate it, you took it, because it kept scurvy away from you, you see. And you'd have some probably chopped up Spam again. Well, at dinner at night was the same. It was either roast Spam, or we lived in Spam. The Americans had a supply of Spam, which they were very good to help us out with, you know. But after a while, you began to suffer from, you know, malnutrition illnesses, which we didn't realize at the time. There was a lot of cases of pyorrhea in your gums, you know, your gums would run. We used to take headaches, we used to take splitting headaches, which would last for days, and we didn't know what it was, but it was lack of vitamins or whatnot due to that time, you see. And somehow or other we survived. But the Americans, who were much better ships than we had, I mean, they had fridges and everything like that. Ours was an old ship, we didn't even have a fridge. They ran out of food, and then they began to go down with scurvy, you see. And it was funny, again, I always remember the funny sides. They came to our ships and they said, look, could you give us an issue of lime juice? You see, on a British ship, when you go below a certain level of fresh food, you have to drink a pint of lime juice every day. Now, that keeps the scurvy away. So the Americans came to us and said, can you give us some lime juice? And of course, we started to laugh. We said, well, we're called limeys, you know, and that's why we're called limeys, because we have to take a ration of lime juice. But we all helped each other out, so we gave the Americans lime juice, you see, and they so they're half limeys, some of them. But we survived like that through the summer, and the summer got very warm in the White Sea, and, you know, I was studying for my chief's ticket at that time, and I used to lock myself away about a couple of hours every afternoon and get my books and get into it, because if I didn't, you just got, you know, you'd no duties to do, you just got sort of, and a degree lazier and lazier. And we built boats and we built rafts and we canoed in the river and and some of the lads swam. I can't swim very well, so I didn't swim, but the time passed eventually. And we found we could send wires home. You couldn't get letters. We only got 4 letters out in the whole year, because you couldn't send letters and you couldn't get letters either. It was very difficult to get letters. But we've discovered you could send telegrams. So we used to go up to Archangel and go to the Naval Control, and they would pass your telegram, and then you went to the post office and they sent it home, you know. You couldn't say very much on it, but at least your people knew you were alive, which was the main thing. So by the time 26th November came along, we had thought, well, you know, it was time to go home. And the Navy formed a convoy, a little convoy, Convoy RA-54B, which was quite a few damaged ships on it, and we set out north, way up to the ice, way up to the edge of the ice, way up out the White Sea and way up into the Arctic Ocean, because we knew that there was a convoy coming up from the south, and we knew that the Germans, if they were going to attack anybody, they would go for the laden one, and hopefully they would forget us. Well, it was dark 24 hours a day. I remember getting into bother at 12 o'clock one day, calling up one of the ships, and I had a red shade in my oldest lamp, which I used to dull the light down. And I got told off by the commodore, your light is far too bright, you know. So, well, I had to put a handkerchief over it or something to dull it down a wee bit more, you know. But that was when we were very north. And then we just were sub-attacks at one time, but the escorts beat them off. And I think at that time I was beginning to feel sorry for the submariners, because it was bitterly cold and we were coated in ice, you know, all the masts and aerial and everything. They were beautiful, like Christmas trees, but rather dangerous, because your ice builds up on deck and you get top heavy, you see. But we got north to Iceland, and then we dropped down and down to London, and we came back to London, and we paid off in London, and we used to laugh in London. We didn't draw money when we were in Russia, because we got a ration of Lucky Strike cigarettes. We used to get 20 a week, you see. Now, they were black market again. I was talking to you early on. You could get nearly 100 rubles for a packet of Lucky Strike. Well, the rate of the ruble at that time, I think, was about 4 rubles to the pound, so you didn't draw any money. So we got back to London, and as I say, we were so thin, we used to laugh amongst ourselves and say, if it hadn't been for the money in our pockets, we'd have fallen down the drains in London. So we broke up. We got fitted out with survivor's gear when we got to London. Our clothes were pretty well rags and tatters, you know. And we set off home and went away home for leave, and that was the end of the Russian run for me.
Can you tell me more about the black market in Russia?
Well, the black, there's always been a black market in Russia, but it was at that time, of course, it was under Stalin, and Russia was not a very nice country to live in. And the Russian people we got on very well with, but the Russian authorities we didn't. I mean, we used to rub each other the wrong way, and if you're doing ship's business, it was sometimes very difficult. But the black market, if you were caught, anybody, if the Russians were caught buying or selling anything in the street to our crowd, or bartering for cigarettes like that, they were really in trouble. They would land in the camps, they would land in the concentration camps. But there was one building set aside which we quickly christened the Skolka market. Skolka is the Russian word for how much. And in that building, at certain hours, you could go and trade for things, you know. You could buy, the peasants would bring in eggs, you could buy eggs occasionally. They were about 5 ruble a time, but it didn't matter. And if you had anything to sell, you could sell it there. And funnily enough, my second radio officer, who was a camera enthusiast, he arrived back with a Leica plate camera one day that I don't know where it had come from. It probably was stolen off some Germans in the fighting further south, but he was quite proud of his camera. He never had any plates to use it, but he eventually got it home with him. But that was the back market. But the system at that time, round in the White Sea, it was the concentration camp area. Molotovsk was a very bad area. It was all concentration camps, and life, I'm afraid, didn't mean very much. Life didn't mean anything at all. It was Russians that were in these concentration camps. They were starving. We were just hungry. They were starving. And if you threw anything in the dock, they dug it out and they scraped it clean and they ate it. And consequently, the authorities stopped us throwing anything in the dock, and they made us put it into a big tub at the top of the accommodation ladder. And every night, a lorry would come round and the two guys would come and collect this tub. Now, that's when the trouble used to start, because on the quay, there was a whole lot of coal tips on the quay, and the Russian people out of the concentration camps, convicts, I suppose you would call them, they would be working there. But when they saw the two walking across to go up for this tub of slop, they would stop work, and the guards, they would load up their rifles. And of course, we knew what was going to happen. It used to make our blood boil. But the two fellows who would come up the accommodation ladder, pick up this big tub of slop, really, and not a great lot of food, but some food in it that had been thrown out, and they would walk down the go down the accommodation ladder, walk across the quay towards the lorry, and there'd be a mad rush of these convicts to get a hand into the slop barrel to grab a bit of it, you know, anything at all, just grab anything. And the guards would wade into them with the butts of their rifles, and it used to make our blood boil, but it was not a thing we could do. I mean, we were tied. We would end up getting shot ourselves if we'd interfered. But that was the time of Russia under Stalin. Now, I go back to Russia a lot now, and it is vastly different altogether from that. And we've a lot of good friends in Russia, and a lot of them didn't even know these things were going on. I had a young, last year in May last year, 1990, I was talking to a young interpreter. She was asking about times during the war, you know, and I was telling her about that. And that girl didn't really know about that. That's into, and I don't talk a great lot about that now, because I just put it into Russian history, which is past. And the Russian people are very, very friendly, very hospitable people. I'm going back in August this year. And the biggest problem I have, one lady, she's the principal head of the English department in the teacher training college. She wants me and my wife to stay with her. And another lady wants us to stay with her. Another lady wants us to go to Somorovorsk, which is the naval base down the inlet from Murmansk. And another school, the head teacher in another school, which we visited last year. I think, Conrad, you've spoken to a friend of mine who lost both his legs, didn't he?
Yes.
Well, we went back in May last year, and he managed to get into this school, which had been a military hospital during the war. And he found the place where his bed had been, and he found the theater where he lost his legs. And May last year, he actually met the doctor that had taken his legs off. He probably would tell you that. Is that correct?
I think so.
That's correct. That's right. You must have seen him since May last year. That is right. You have done. But she wants us to go and see her, and it's just impossible. I mean, I can't get round them all. But I'm looking forward to going back to Murmansk in August, because we get a wonderful time when we go there.
How much did the Russians do to help the convoys in militarily?
Well, I wouldn't. I really couldn't say too much on that point. They didn't have enough air cover, but then they didn't have it. They just hadn't got it. You must remember, it's very easy to criticize. It's very easy to criticize the Russians, but they hadn't the resources. They were trying to kick they were hammering the gates of Moscow not so long before that, and anything they had, they were using in the south to beat the Germans back to free their own country. They had planes, and I mean, we used to see them going out from the Enga airfield, I think it was, and going out across the lines to bomb the Germans up in the front and beyond that in the German airfields. And as far as the Navy ships, they hadn't a great lot of Navy ships when we were there. They had a few destroyers, and I've seen an odd cruiser around in the White Sea. But I wouldn't be in a position to, you know, not knowing. I wouldn't be in any. We never saw a great lot of them when we were at sea, to be fair. But I wouldn't like to criticise. I mean, a lot of criticism has already been said, but you must take the overall position. We would have loved if they had plenty of aircraft to defend us from these fighter bombers, but they didn't have them. Anything they had were Hurricanes that we'd given them. And I've seen Air Cobras, and I've seen different British and American planes there, but they were flown by Russian pilots.
Do they seem to be glad of these tanks that you'd brought?
Oh yes, the tanks would be sent away south right away, there's no question. I mean, most of the equipment was sent south, you know, down to the fighting in the southern part of the country. And I mean, we had food, we had everything. A merchant ship carries an awful lot of stuff, you know, with anti-tank guns, with tanks, with Hurricanes and crates. We had food, we had explosives, we had TNT, we had cordite, which anti-tank shells by the thousands. We had everything you could think of. Food was quite important, you know, and we had clothing actually as well for them, you know. But we lost. It's strange. The losses in that run, there was nearly 1,000. There was yes, nearly 1,000. 990 odd merchant sailors died on the Russian run. And there was 2,500 Royal Navy men died in the Russian run. Now, there was 99 ships, I think, lost between the weather and the Germans on that run. And the Navy lost, I think it's 17. And people may wonder about the difference in the number of losses. They were much higher in the Navy. But the Navy lost two cruisers. And I think, as I said earlier, in a cruiser you'd maybe have 1,200 men. Well, you see, in a merchant ship you maybe had 50-odd men. Well, if the crew could get away, they would get away much easier. Don't get me wrong. if you explode, nobody gets away. But if you were just torpedoed and sinking, you have a better chance of getting away in a merchantman when there's only about 50 people than there is with 1,200 people. There's not lifeboats or there's not rafts for 1,200 people on a cruiser. It's as simple as that. And in these waters, you know, you died very quickly because the sea temperature, well, I don't know what the sea temperature was, but the air temperature was sometimes 30, 40. 30 below was common. 30 below freezing point was common. I've seen it 40 and further on than that below freezing point, you know. So you hadn't much chance in the water.
You mentioned the ice. Did you have to chip away the ice?
Well, the ice formed on deck. We used to have to chip it away on deck because it built, you know, the bulwarks on a ship's side are about up to your, you know, normal, when you're standing on a steel deck in a merchantman, it's normally up to about your waist. But when the bulwarks, the sea, anything that came, the ice on deck, snow and ice formed up, you meant your bulwarks were only about 3 feet, you see. And when it was rough weather, it was very dangerous, but to get along the deck, you had to wait till the ship, if you were going from one part of accommodation to another, along, suppose I was going from where my accommodation was, past the central hatch, the bunker hatches, to get up to the bridge ladder, to go up to the bridge. I would open my door and wait till the ship rolled that way, you see, and then it was just pure ice with water sloshing on it. So I would skate along that ice, along the side of the hatch, and grab the bridge ladder before she swung the other way. Because if I tried to go over when she was swinging that way, I would have landed in the scuppers and I might have gone over the side, because it was only about three foot bulwark instead of, you know, up to your chest height. And but that ice got very heavy and you had to spend some time chipping it off, and it was about maybe a couple of feet of ice on it, you know. And we used to, not so much at sea because we hadn't the time, but in port you had to keep it down because it got too heavy, it got too thick.
What were you wearing?
Well, we wore, it was rather funny, you know, young fellows, we got issued with Arctic gear before we left the Clyde. And among the Arctic gear were, not to be indelicate, there was what they called long johns, you know, and they were about half an inch thick. And of course, all the young fellows were saying, oh, I wouldn't be seen dead in these things, you know. I can tell you, about a month later, we had two pairs on, we were still freezing. Well, you had them on, you see, and then we had we were issued with a Navy. The naval ratings have a very tight-knit woolen jumper with a sort of slit neck that goes over your head, and it's quite tight, and it keeps you warm. And then you'd have your normal uniform on top of that, of course. And on top of that, you could have, we used to get fur-lined sheepskin waistcoats, really, Navy Army issue, I think, that you could clip on. And then on top of the whole lot of that, you could put you had your big duffel coat, which was a canvas duffel coat, canvas on the outside and sheepskin lined on the inside, with a big hood on it, you see. And also they issued us with what they called visors, which was basically a bag with fur lining on the inside, which went over your head, with slits for the eye holes, you know, open holes for the eyes and a hole for your nose. But none of us ever wore these, because what happened was your breath froze inside and you ended up with a cake of ice against your face. So we used to cut the inside out and just wear them like that. That's another thing that people... I often, you know, when we go back to Russia with people going back perhaps for the first time. First time I went back was 1918, and I went back in February in the winter time. So I warned them, I said, when you get off the plane in Murmansk, the first thing you'll notice that you're not used to is the hairs on your nostrils will freeze up. And it feels like chips of wood up your nose, you see. And this is just the cold, it's just the condensation on the hairs on your nose freezing. And you just get used to that. But we used to come down off the bridge and literally, you know, we had your fur hat on. One side of your face would be coated in snow, had frozen. If it was a blizzard, it would freeze up the side of your face, you know, you'd be able to see out it. But you would come down to your cabin and shake your head, and the bits were falling off your face. The cold was a very important feature, actually. But put it this way, our accommodation was quite comfortable. I was in a two-berth cabin with another officer on there, and we couldn't complain. We were quite warm on the ship. But outside was a different story. It got very, very cold. Tell you another case, again on the Monkey Island up above the bridge, which is again open to the air. We were up there once during the convoy on the way up, and the steward came up with us with three mugs of cocoa, you see, and we had a little table where we used to keep charts on. So we shifted the charts off, and he dumped his cocoa down, and some of it slopped over. I was talking to the captain. I turned around less than a minute later, and I went to get my cocoa, and I couldn't get it off the chart table. It was frozen solid onto the chart table, just where the stuff had slopped over the side had frozen, and then it had cooled down and frozen solid. And that was a common thing, you see. The cold was very, very quick, which made it another thing. The gunners couldn't, to watch, they didn't touch the guns with their bare hands, because they could get what they called, I think it's a frost burn, you know, your skin would stick to it, and you could lose your skin off the sudden cold. Frostbite, I never had any frostbite. My mate had lost a bit of his ear, it got frozen, because the temperature went up one day, and everything is by comparison. You know, we'd lived 30 below for a long time, and then the spring began to come, and it got a wee bit warmer, and we went up the bridge, and it was only about 5 or 6 below. And he thought, oh, I'm not going ashore with my big fur hat on, I'll just put on my uniform hat, you see. And he got the top of his ears frostbitten for that, so he learned not to be so silly.
Did he lose his ear?
No, he lost a wee bit off the top of his ear, but he didn't lose his ear. No, it wasn't bad enough for that. He began to feel the cold. He gets numb, and he just can't get the circulation going. But he was all right. But that, apart from that, I don't think we had any cases of frostbite. We were fortunate. But again, as our friend, you know, Bill Short, whom I've spoken to you about before, he lost both his legs with frostbite because he was in a lifeboat for 4 days, you see, and full of water, and it's not surprising. But that was the Russian run, as far as I can remember it.
You've already said something about the cardium.
Yes.
Is there anything in the latter part of the war from your experiences that we should recount?
Well, it was mostly peaceful, I would say. You know, what was after the cardium? It was the troop ship. That was we were carrying troops from. That was at the end of the war as well. We used to run down to West Africa with troops. That was a good job. We'd leave the Clyde and we would go down to Gibraltar, and then we would go to Bathurst, Freetown, Takoradi, Lagos, and back up the coast and back home, and I could be back home in about 3 weeks to a month. So that suited me fine. I did a few voyages that way, you see. I could visit.